in our schools in all America, but down here we're not going to allow it. Some good folks formed white citizens' councils to keep things sensible in the Delta. Those damn Yankees think they can tell us how to run our lives. Well, they better think again. He looked real serious. I tell you, son, around here, we're not going to take this integration craziness lying down. Not us, not here, not ever. The more he talked about the Supreme Court's ruling, the more agitated Grandpa became. And I was glad when we pulled up in front of the River Cafe. Maybe we'd run into enough of his old buddies that he'd have something else to talk about besides schools and Negroes. I'd had enough tension for one day. Chapter 7 Monday afternoon, I convinced Grandpa to drive out with me to look at the fields. He complained a little, but once we were on Old Money Road, his mood improved. He set his elbow out the truck window, leaned back, took a deep breath, and smiled.
"This is where a man should be, Hiram. Working the earth. Planting, cultivating, harvesting. That's what made the South great, and that's what still sustains this country. Hilburn folk have worked the land for generations. Held on to it, expanded it, kept it to pass on to our children."
He poked me in the shoulder.
"Your daddy should have stayed here, son. He should be out there right now looking after Hilburn land and Hilburn crops."
When we reached the first of Grandpa's fields, I steered the truck onto a dirt road and let it roll to a stop alongside the edge of the cotton rows. "Bet it feels good to be out here again, Grandpa," I said.
"Yep,"
he said. But he looked sad again.
"Feels great to see the fruits of my labors. Awful glad you came, son. Awful glad."
He took a deep breath and sighed.
"But I do wish Harlan were here, too. You remind me of him, Hiram, now more than ever before. I miss my boy."
I knew Grandpa wanted me to say that Dad missed him, too. That he wanted to come to Greenwood and just couldn't get away from work. That someday we'd all be back here again. But it wasn't true, and Grandpa would know it. I didn't want to talk or even think about Dad, so I didn't say anything. We sat without talking for a while, watching the breeze stir the tops of the cotton plants. Finally, Grandpa spoke.
"You know, sometimes you wish you could go back and change things with people. I loved Harlan and treated him right, but somewhere he went haywire. Or we went haywire. Seemed to always get along with his mother, but soured on me when he turned 12. That's when he started acting contrary, and nothing I did could shake it out of him. It got so I didn't even know how to talk to him anymore. Florence, God bless her, tried to help. Harlan had listened to her. I know he loves the Delta. It's in his blood, but I've never understood why he wouldn't stay."
A tear ran down his cheek, but he ignored it.
"It's damn hard being old and alone, Hiram,"
he said in a voice so soft I could hardly hear him.
"Too damn hard."
I felt a catch in my throat and a sadness that reached clear back to my childhood. I hadn't seen Grandpa cry since that day Grandma died. More than anything, I wanted to hug him, to tell him things would be all right someday. My big old grandfather, who had always been strong and loud and cheerful, now seemed pitiful, sad, and hopeless. I wished he and Dad could talk, could be together again. I wanted him to be happy, but I didn't know how to make it happen. The only thing I could think to say was, "I'm sorry, Grandpa. Really, I am." I couldn't tell if he heard me or not. Nobody said anything for a while. Then Grandpa straightened up and cleared his throat.
"Let's head on up through Money," he said, "and I'll show you how to find our old fishing hole on the Tallahatchie."
I started the truck and followed his directions up and down the dirt farm roads until we came to our fishing spot. From there we drove through a lot of LaFleur County, not stopping anywhere but driving past the fields of Grandpa's friends,
and going through little towns where he'd done some business once or had a great meal or two. Seeing those familiar places brightened him up, and by the time we were headed back to Greenwood, he said, "Let's not go home just yet. Why don't we drive over to the county courthouse? I haven't been there in weeks, and I've got some business to tend to." I drove us back through town and over to the Yazoo on the Fulton Street Bridge and parked in front of the LaFleur County Courthouse. Grandpa couldn't wait to get out of the truck. "I wonder if Eddie Chrysler is still working. Come on, Hiram, and we'll wake the old devil up." Mr. Chrysler stood and smiled when Grandpa and I came in. "Earl, you rascal," he said. "How have you been?"
"Been better," said Grandpa. "You know about my stroke of bad luck."
Both men laughed at his dumb joke, then started talking about fishing and folks in town and who died and who hadn't. When Mr. Chrysler mentioned something about the citizens' councils, Grandpa cleared his throat and looked my way.
"Hiram, Mr. Chrysler and I have some serious business to tend to for the next little while."
Just like old times, he reached into his pocket, pulled out a dime, and flipped it to me.
"Why don't you run down the lobby and say hi to Mr. Paul? Bet he won't recognize you."
I strolled down the main lobby of the courthouse toward Mr. Paul's concession stand. It had been 7 years, almost half my life, since I'd been there, but nothing had changed. My footsteps echoed off the marble floor like they always had. Old Mr. Taylor, the security guard, still stood outside the courtroom door, and there in the middle of the main lobby was Mr. Paul's little stand, just as I remembered it. Mr. Paul looked the same, except he wasn't wearing dark glasses now, and as I got closer, I saw that he'd framed his Purple Heart medal from the war and hung it on the wall behind his stand. When he heard my footsteps, he turned my way and smiled.
"Can I help you?"
he asked.
"Hey, Mr. Paul, it's me, Hiram Hilburn, back from Arizona to visit."
"Well, well, Hiram, how's the world been treating you?"
"Better than it has your grandpa, I hope."
"I've been missing Greenwood something awful," I said. "But Arizona's not all that bad. I've got two brothers and two sisters now."
"Isn't that something? Guess your folks are doing well and your daddy's happy."
"Yes, sir, he likes teaching at the college.
Shame he's too busy to come back once in a while to visit old Earl. It was hard on him when y'all moved away."
Mr. Paul stepped back and sat on a stool behind the counter.
"So what brings you in here today? Your grandpa doing business again?"
"Yes, sir, and he sent me down here with a dime. Have you got any cold root beer?" He reached behind him into an ice chest, pulled out a bottle of frosty root beer, opened it, and set it on the counter. I snapped my dime on the countertop, and he picked it up and dropped it into his change tray.
"Pleasure doing business with you, Hiram. You going to be in Greenwood long?"
"A couple of weeks, I guess. Dad says I've got to get back in time for school."
"You don't sound too happy about that."
"School's all right. But Grandpa's been feeling pretty lonely, and I kind of wanted to help him get around as long as I can." I took a swig of root beer and asked,
"So what's new in Greenwood?"
"Same old small-town things. Babies get born, old folks die. A few young kids run off and get married. Sitting here where I do all day, I hear most of what goes on. Lately, lots of folks have been pretty hot about school integration. Those fellows on the Supreme Court didn't make many friends down here."
"You think they're really going to integrate?"
"Over some folks' dead bodies, I'd say. Your grandpa and his friends and the White Citizens' Council are pretty worked up over it. They're dead set on keeping the colored schools separate from the white. It's the way of the South and all that."
"But don't Negroes want their own schools just like we do?"
"Ever been to a colored school, Hiram?"
"No, sir."
"I went to one once before the war to fix a plumbing leak they had in a colored elementary school. The building wasn't much more than a big shack. Kids didn't have any books that I could see. The school desks were older than I was. The principal told me that she'd been calling the county office about the water leak for 4 months before I finally showed up, and all that time the school had been without water."
"How come you didn't go sooner?"
"Hiram, I went the day after the county office called me about it. Nobody cared that the colored school didn't have any water.
So how'd you like to go to a school with outdoor privies, no books, rickety old desks, and no water most of the time? But how do you know that's not just one school? Other colored schools might be better. This is Mississippi, Hiram. The South. Most colored schools are lucky to see 10 cents of every school tax dollar. The rest goes to the white schools, the kind you went to when you lived here. Jim Crow laws keep things separate, not equal. And if those white citizens' councils have anything to say about it, Jim Crow will rule the South until doomsday. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with people keeping to their own kind? Grandpa used to say that that's the way God wants it. Hiram, Mr. Paul's face turned serious. Maybe God put different kinds of people on earth so we could all learn to get along. Ever think about that? Mr. Paul turned toward the sound of footsteps coming our way. You getting this boy what he needs? It was Grandpa. That you, Earl? You've been away too long. Guess it took your grandson visiting to pry you out of that big old easy chair. Grandpa laughed. That's just about right. It's been good having the boy around again. He makes getting out a heck of a lot more fun. They talked for a while about Mr. Paul's children, the weather, and local politics, but nobody said anything about integration or the citizens' councils. Just polite, empty talk. Pretty soon, Mr. Paul said he had to close up shop because his wife would be coming by to take him home. We said goodbye and went home to dinner. Ruth Ann fed us like kings again. Grandpa ate well but didn't say much. All the driving around and visiting we'd done must have taken a lot out of him, because as soon as dinner was over, he went straight to bed. The house was quiet and dark when I went upstairs. I wasn't all that tired, but that's not why I had a hard time sleeping. Thinking about how lonely Grandpa was made me sad, especially because there wasn't a thing I could do about it, and because I knew that unless a bolt of lightning struck Dad, there'd be no way he'd offer to patch things up with Grandpa. And I was thinking about what Mr. Paul had said. In Tempe, segregation never seemed to be a big deal. In Greenwood, things were different. It wasn't just the schools. Restaurants, movie theaters, stores, even the neighborhoods were divided into white or colored. And the white places were always 100 times nicer. The Jim Crow laws kept the Negroes pretty much stuck where they were, with no hope of things ever getting better. Their future must have seemed hopeless. Then I thought about Emmett. He seemed like a regular kid, even though his skin wasn't the same color as mine. I couldn't imagine him going to a colored school, and maybe in Chicago he didn't have to. Maybe there, things were different. Maybe like Mr. Paul had said, God didn't want to keep us separate. He wanted us to get along. Maybe. And this was a surprising thought. Dad's ideas weren't so crazy after all. I'd have to think about that for a while. I could see where segregation wasn't very fair, but it wasn't the same as something like the Nazis killing all those Jews. It seemed to me that Negroes weren't really being hurt, it was just the way things were. And I couldn't see why people like Dad and Mr. Paul got so worked up over it, especially when it had nothing to do with them. Dad, Grandpa, Mr. Paul, and Emmett stayed on my mind for quite a while, but none of them seemed to be suffering. Things couldn't be as bad as either Grandpa or Dad made them out to be. As it got later, I found something better to think about. Naomi Rydell. When would I see her? Far as I was concerned, the sooner the better. Chapter 8. R.C. Rydell had gotten bigger. I ran into him Tuesday downtown at the P&S drugstore, where he was slouched against the front wall looking bored and smoking filterless Viceroys. He stood at least 6 feet tall and had round, powerful shoulders and thick forearms. A jagged line ran across his right cheek, and his eyebrows were crisscrossed with thin white scars. When he saw me, he flicked a smoldering cigarette butt in my direction.
"What in hell are you doing here?"
"We figured when y'all run out to Arizona, we'd never see you again." He grinned and shoved me back a step.
"Shoot, Hiram, you done grown up. How long's it been?"
7 years. We left in 48.
"Wasn't much after that I quit school."
"Wasting my time there," Pa said. "He got me a man's job unloading freight barges that come down the Yazoo. Didn't need no schooling for that."
"So what you doing nowadays?"
"Still in high school back in Arizona. I'll be in 11th grade next month."
"Figures,"
R.C. said with a snort.
"You always was a sis baby. I'll bet school suits you just fine. So how come you're here in Greenwood? You running from the law?"
"No, just visiting Grandpa. He's been sick, you know, and none of us have been back to see him since we moved."
"Yeah, I heard he was a cripple or something now. Too bad, 'cause he always had things squared away pretty good, if you ask me."
I really didn't feel like asking R.C. anything, so I stepped around him and reached for the drugstore door. "Good seeing you, R.C., but I've got to be getting Grandpa's medicine." R.C. moved aside to let me pass, but put a hand on my shoulder to stop me.
"Tell you what, Hiram, we ain't got no barges coming down for another couple days, so why don't we go fishing tomorrow? I can see if you learned anything since you've been in Arizona. It'll be like old times."
Old times with R.C. hadn't always been fun, but maybe fishing wouldn't be so bad. He was 18 and probably had mellowed some since we were kids, and maybe he'd let me know what Naomi was doing and if there was some way I could see her.
"Yeah, okay.
If he hasn't already loaned it out to one of his friends, we can probably use Grandpa's truck and drive out to the Tallahatchie instead of walking down the Yazoo. Last week he showed me how to get to his favorite fishing hole out there." R.C. leaned back against the storefront and lit another Viceroy.
"I'll come by in the morning, and maybe I'll be able to steal a little of Pa's beer to keep us from dying of thirst while we's fishing."
"No need for any beer, especially in the morning." I knew R.C. and beer would be a bad combination.
"Lemonade'll do me just fine. I'll bring a thermos of it." "I should have figured you'd be a sis baby. You don't smoke or drink." "Don't matter. I'll bring my beer. You bring your lemonade. We'll have us some fun."
He took a long drag on his cigarette and let the smoke drift out his nostrils.
"See you around, Hiram."
That night, Grandpa said we could use his pickup truck.
"From what I hear lately, it'll do R.C. some good going fishing with a nice boy like you. If nothing else, it'll keep him out of mischief. Won't hurt you any either, Hiram. You need to get out with some boys your own age. Hanging around with an old man like me all the time can't be much fun. Just make sure you bring us back some catfish. Ruth Ann can put together some hush puppies and fry up those fish, and we'll have us a meal you won't forget."
Ruth Ann insisted on fixing me a lunch to take along with my lemonade, and when I picked up the canvas bag on my way out the next morning, it felt as jam-packed as anything Grandma had ever made. She didn't have to do that, I knew, but that's how Ruth Ann was. It felt good to leave the house on a fishing trip with enough lunch for me and R.C., just like old times. By the time I had my fishing gear in the back of the truck and my lunch sack on the front seat, R.C. showed up, looking ragged and red-eyed. "You okay?" I asked when he climbed into the truck.
"Had a long night," he said. "Stuff a sis baby like you wouldn't know nothing about. I'll be fine by the time we're out at the river."
"Hey, R.C., how's Naomi doing? I haven't had a chance to talk to her since I got back." He looked surprised. Then his eyebrows arched up and he grinned.
"Oh, yeah, I forgot about you two. Regular little lovebirds when you was here before. I should have told her you was back in Greenwood, but I got in kinda late and Pa was on a bender. She's smart enough to make herself scarce when Pa's ripping.
But she's doing all right? I mean, she's okay?" Look at here, sis baby. I take care of my little sister. Not that she needs it much anymore, but long as I'm around, don't nobody hurt her. Of course, I keep the Romeos away, too, but in your case, old buddy, I'll make an exception. Naomi always was sweet on you. He leaned back and looked me over. But I don't know what she's going to think of the growed up and ugly version of you. When you get home, tell her I said hey, will you? Let her know I'm in town and maybe sometime we can... R.C. held up a hand to stop me. Hold on a minute. I said I'd let you see my sister, but I didn't say I'd make all your damn appointments. You work out your own matchmaking, Hiram Hilburn. If Naomi wants to see you, she'll see you. She don't, she won't. And if that happens to be the case, you dadgum better not be bothering her about it. Enough about your love life. Let's get out of here. He held up a brown paper sack. Got us? Sorry, I got me 6 bottles of Pa's beer to help get through the day. Good thing you don't drink, Hiram boy, 'cause these 6 will be barely enough for me. He set the beer alongside the bulging lunch sack on the seat between us. What you got here? Ruth Ann packed us a lunch. Looks like we'll have plenty. R.C. didn't grab the sack like I'd expected him to. Ruth Ann, that nigger girl your granddaddy got working for him? Ever since Grandma died, and she's a great cook, just as good as Grandma ever was. He pushed the bag away. Be a cold day in hell before I eat nigger food. Don't matter how good it is. Never did understand your granddaddy on that. He's right thinking in most ways, but he lets a nigger in and out of his house like she's family. He smirked and raised an eyebrow. But who knows? Maybe she's been doing a whole lot more than just cooking and cleaning. You're nuts, R.C. Right then I wanted to pop him in the jaw. Grandpa's not like that, and neither is Ruth Ann. Just can it for a while, will you? He looked surprised. Then he grinned and reached in his shirt pocket and pulled out a cigarette. Looks like Arizona's turned you into a nigger lover. He lit the cigarette and tossed the match out the window. Fine, just fine. I don't like talking about coloreds anyway. You're driving, let's go get some fish. I backed out the driveway and turned onto Cotton Street just as Ronnie Remington was crossing in front of us on his way to the courthouse. He moved slowly, his head down, oblivious to us. R.C. reached over and pounded the truck horn. Ronnie's head snapped up, his eyes huge, and he stopped dead in the road in front of us like an old cow caught in the glare of a car's headlights. R.C. honked the horn twice more, then leaned out his window, pounded the side of the door with his arm, and yelled, "Move your fat ass, you old queer!" Ronnie looked terrified when he recognized R.C., and he wobbled as quickly as he could to the sidewalk while R.C. whooped and catcalled. Ronnie stood frozen and pale as we drove past, and R.C. laughed like a crazy man. I couldn't help laughing, too. Jeez, R.C., you almost gave him a heart attack. I thought he was going to jump out of his shoes. Yeah, them old Remingtons is always good for a laugh. A couple of years ago, every time I'd catch me a carp, I'd slice its guts open and leave it in their mailbox. No kidding? I bet they hated getting mail. That's nothing. Last year I got so fed up seeing them two fairies walking around town that I offered Ralph a ride one day when I had Pa's truck, and instead of taking him home, I headed out of town. We drove 10 minutes before he even said anything. What'd he do? What could the old weirdo do? I could bust him in half if I wanted. Anyways, I stopped the truck and tell him I like him so much I want all his clothes. He stared at me with his mouth hanging open like some stupid fish. Get out and give me your clothes, I told him. He just sat there like an idiot, so I slapped him around a little. He started moaning and crying and finally got out. Made him strip naked. Boy, was that a sorry sight. If I had a body like his, I'd shoot myself. Felt so sorry for him, I tossed his shoes back before I drove off. This didn't sound funny anymore. You left him there, naked? Didn't hurt him none. I saw him around town again a couple days later. Some sappy old farmer probably picked him up and give him a feed bag or something to cover up with. You know how people around here put up with them Remingtons.
R.C. hadn't changed. And I would have turned around and gone back home if I could have thought up a good excuse. I didn't say anything more to R.C., and after a few minutes, he leaned his head against the door and fell asleep. I felt lousy the rest of the way to the Tallahatchie.
R.C. Rydell was one screwed-up kid, and for the life of me, I couldn't understand why he, or anyone, would enjoy making other people miserable. Maybe R.C. was so miserable himself that he was always looking for somebody or something he could make worse off than he was. But he always took it too far. It's one thing to have a little fun with someone, teasing and stuff like that, but R.C. was just plain mean. And to tell you the truth, he scared the crap out of me.
When I finally parked the truck at the clearing not far from Grandpa's fishing hole, I was feeling better. The lush green of the delta and the heavy damp smell from the fields helped me get my mind on something other than R.C.'s bullying.
R.C. woke up when I opened my door.
"Where are we?"
He looked around, confused.
"Don't know for sure. A few miles from money. Grandpa and I used to come here all the time when I was a kid. It's a good spot. Anyway, you can sleep some more if you want. I'm heading to the river to get settled."
"Good idea."
R.C. leaned his head back, closed his eyes, and waved me away.
"I'll come down after I get me some more beauty rest."
I grabbed the lunch sack, picked up my fishing gear, and worked my way down to the river's edge. I was glad to be alone. The morning sky was clear blue, the grass damp and dew-streaked. The sound of the wind in the trees and the flow of the Tallahatchie made me want to hurry up and find a shady spot to take a nap. I followed the narrow path parallel to the river for a few minutes until I recognized a place under an old cypress tree. I tucked the lunch bag up against the tree trunk, baited my hook, and cast out into the middle of the river. Then I sat down against the tree and watched the water. It felt great to be fishing again, but it didn't seem right without Grandpa. He needed to be there, because even though I loved the Delta countryside, that wasn't what I'd been missing. What I really wanted was to relive some of my favorite experiences, experiences that always included Grandpa. When I was little, he'd taught me to fish somewhere around here. I'd never had a bad day with Grandpa while we were fishing. Never saw him lose his temper. Never had him get mad when I snagged my line or lost a fish. You know, he probably didn't care at all about catching fish back then. He took me fishing because he enjoyed spending time with me. I wondered about Dad and Grandpa. Had Dad ever stood here with Grandpa's arms around him, helping him cast a line? Had they ever told stories? Joked and splashed together on the riverbank while they cleaned the day's catch? Suddenly, it mattered a lot that they had. As much as I loved my good times with Grandpa, I didn't want them to be a substitute for what he should have done with Dad when he was a boy. My childhood memories with Grandpa might be something, might be one of the only things Dad and I had in common. And I made up my mind that when I got back to Tempe, I'd ask Dad about it. All my serious thinking ended when a rock ricocheted off the tree just above my head.
"Woo-wee, Hiram boy, you in a trance or what? I could have snuck up on you, slit your throat, swiped your lunch, and drove away in your truck without you even knowing it."
R.C. tramped down to the riverbank.
"You been drinking, boy?"
"Just thinking. That's one of the things I like about being here."
"No wonder you never catch no fish."
R.C. set his pole down to bait his hook.
"There's got to be somebody paying attention at your end of that pole, or those fish'll strip your hook clean."
He pulled a bottle of beer from his bag.
"Let me show you how this is supposed to be done, boy. First, you got to wet your whistle. The faster the better."
He popped the cap off the bottle with his pocket knife, then chugged the entire beer without hardly taking a breath.
"Ah, that's better."
He tossed the empty bottle into the river.
Now, fish, look out, I'm a-coming for you.
R.C. walked a few yards downstream and cast his line into the river. Minutes later, I heard him whoop.
Got me one! Hoo boy, this is going to be a good day!
He pulled his stringer from his pocket and strung the fish on it.
Tell you one thing, Hiram, your granddaddy sure knows where the fish are.
The rest of the morning went like that, R.C. guzzling beer and pulling in fish. By noon, he had a stringer full of fish and a belly full of beer. He was red-faced and a little unsteady when he trudged over and dropped down alongside me.
All that fishing's made me hungry, Hiram boy. What you got for lunch?
I almost reminded him of what he'd said about Ruth Ann's food, but figured I didn't want him to knock my teeth down my throat. Help yourself to whatever's in there. We got plenty. He pulled out two sandwiches, tore the wax paper off one, and tossed the other to me.
Eat up, boy. Can't work on no empty stomach.
He set the lunch sack between us, and we dug in. I hadn't realized how hungry I was, and, of course, Ruth Ann had packed us a sack lunch better than most people's suppers. We had lots more than we could eat. While we ate, R.C. talked about how many fish he'd caught, his work down on the docks, and some raunchy stuff about girls he'd known. I knew most of his stories were a bunch of baloney, but it was mostly harmless stuff, so I didn't sweat it. I hadn't slept much the night before, and Ruth Ann's lunch combined with the heavy afternoon air hit me like a sleeping drug. R.C. was yawning, too, so I said, "No place better in the Delta for a quiet nap than right in the shade of one of these willow trees. After we wake up, we can decide if we want to fish some more or head back into town." R.C. settled into a shady spot a few yards downstream and was snoring in minutes. I didn't last much longer. I don't know how long I'd been asleep when I jerked awake. It took a moment for my head to clear, but when it did, I heard splashing and laughter from upstream. 30 or 40 yards from us, where the bank sloped gradually into shallow water, 4 Negro boys were horsing around in the water. Dressed only in cut-off pants, all of them were soaking wet. They were playing some sort of 3-on-1, where 3 of them ganged up on one to dunk him. I watched them wrestle, splash, and laugh. They were really having a good time splashing their way downstream, and when they were close enough, I recognized one of them. Emmett wasn't the biggest kid, but he was the best at playing their game. He was as wet as any of them, but he was always one of the dunkers and never the dunkee. A couple of the boys saw me sitting in the shade of that tree, and as soon as they did, they stopped dead, pointed at me, and motioned to the others to head back upstream. Emmett didn't want to stop, and he was the last one to see me. He held one hand over his eyes to shade his view. Then he recognized me, waved, and started walking toward me. The other boys grabbed him.
"You crazy?" one said. "Let's get out of here for this trouble."
"Trouble?" Emmett waved a hand at them.
"That's one of my friends, the old Tallahatchie lifeguard. He ain't no trouble."
"He's white," hissed another one of the boys. "That's trouble enough.
Didn't I tell you I had white friends up in Chicago?"
He slogged through the shallow water and onto the riverbank. I wanted to keep him as far away from R.C. as I could, so I jumped up and met him at the bank. When he saw me coming, he turned to his friends and said,
"See? Told you we was friends."
"Hey, Emmett," I said, "what you all up to?"
"Just goofing around with some of my cousins. Too hot to be anywhere but in the water." "What are you doing? Fishing or sleeping?"
"Little of both, I guess. Ruth Ann's lunch and this old Mississippi sun pretty much wiped me out."
"Lunch?" Emmett's face lit up. "We're starving. Got anything left?"
Emmett's friends had stayed behind him a ways in the water, close enough to hear but far enough away to escape if they had to.
"Aw, geez, Emmett," said one. "Let's just get on home. No need to be hanging round here."
Emmett waved a hand behind his back and said without even turning around,
Y'all go on if you want to. I'm going to get me something to eat.
The boys didn't move.
Told you, said one. He's crazy.
They all laughed and splashed water at him.
Wait here, I told Emmett. I'll go grab my lunch sack and you all can have whatever's left in it.
I started back to the tree where I'd left my stuff, but Emmett followed me.
Shoot, he said. I don't want to stand out there with that old sun beating down on me, eating my lunch. No snakes up around that tree, is there?
When they saw him follow me up on the shore, Emmett's friends whooped and laughed.
Go, Bobo, one yelled. Go, you crazy boy.
I turned around and faced him. Look, it'd be better if you stayed down there. My friend's sleeping over there, and he probably doesn't want to get woke up.
Hey, any friend of yours is a friend of mine, Emmett said with a grin. Now let's see what Ruth Ann packed us for lunch.
He wasn't going to listen, so I figured the best thing to do was to give him my lunch and get him out of there. I handed him the sack as his cousins kept laughing and yelling at him. He ignored them. Unfortunately, R.C. didn't. He came up from behind and shoved me out of the way so he was facing Emmett himself.
What the hell's going on here? He said slowly.
R.C.'s face was red and he smelled like stale beer.
Looks like you caught yourself one hell of a colored fish, Hiram.
He snorted through his nose, cleared his throat, and spit at Emmett's feet.
Too bad it's a trash fish. You'll have to throw him back.
I had a feeling something real ugly was about to happen. For some reason, maybe because he didn't know R.C., Emmett didn't seem worried at all, even though his cousins had backed away without making a sound.
Let's not have any trouble, R.C., I said. I was just giving Emmett our leftovers.
Giving our lunch to a nigger? You must be as crazy as your pa was.
I'd just as soon throw our food to the fish as see it go to waste on this trash.
He snatched the sack out of Emmett's hand.
You leave this be, Hiram, or I'll fix you, your grandpa, and your whole family real good, I swear to God.
R.C. glared at me with pure hatred, and I backed off, afraid to do anything more.
Hey, Emmett chuckled nervously.
Finally, he must have gotten some good sense.
I didn't mean nothing. My friend here was sharing his lunch, and
R.C. shoved him in the chest.
White folk don't share nothing with colored boy, nothing.
Emmett staggered back a step, but didn't shut up.
Look, I didn't mean anything by it. But he did say we could have that sack. Why don't you just let me have it and we'll get out of here?
Don't you hear, boy? Or are you just tired of breathing?
R.C. threw the lunch sack down and kicked it out of the way.
I've had enough of your uppityness.
He lunged forward and grabbed Emmett in a headlock.
You so hungry, I'll feed you lunch.
R.C. dragged him over to where he'd been fishing. Emmett struggled and complained at first, but R.C. tightened his grip around Emmett's neck, and he quieted down, half scrambling, half being dragged behind R.C. When they got to the riverbank, R.C. threw Emmett on the ground and held him there with one knee on his chest. He reached over and pulled his fish line out of the river and laid the fish across Emmett's bare stomach. When a fish twitched, Emmett flexed upward and tried to twist away, but R.C.'s knee kept him pinned.
Let me go, Emmett yelled. Get off me.
Lunchtime, boy,
R.C. said as he pulled his pocket knife from his pants. He opened the blade and held it over Emmett. Emmett froze.
Come on, R.C., I yelled. Cut it out.
He waved his knife at me.
I warned you once, Hiram. Ain't gonna do it again.
Then he smiled.
Sides, I ain't doing nothing but giving this uppity black boy his lunch.
You hold still, boy, he said to Emmett. I'd hate to see you get hurt by accident. R.C. swung his leg over and sat on Emmett's stomach. Then he slid the fish up to Emmett's neck. His knife blade flashed in the sun.
Come on, get off!
Emmett yelled as he bucked upward, trying to throw R.C. off, but R.C. was too big for him.
Hang on, boy. You don't want me to drop this knife on some vital part, do you? Just sit still while I get you some lunch.
He pulled the largest fish off the stringer and held it in one hand with its white belly facing up.
Carp. You coloreds love carp.
He struck his blade into the tail end of the fish and cut up to its head, letting the blood drip onto Emmett's chest and face. He gagged and yelled for help, but R.C. held him. R.C. threw his knife into the ground just inches from Emmett's face. Emmett didn't move, didn't yell. His eyes looked huge. Then R.C. scraped the guts out of the fish and shoved them in Emmett's face. Emmett thrashed and twisted his head from side to side, and R.C. threw the fish carcass into the river, so he could use one hand to hold Emmett's head still and the other to hold the guts over Emmett's mouth and nose.
R.C., he can't breathe, I yelled. You're going to kill him.
He ignored me, and when Emmett finally opened his mouth for air, R.C. shoved the guts in and rolled off Emmett, laughing.
You wasn't as hungry as you thought, boy,
he said as Emmett retched and rolled on the ground. R.C. shook the blood from his hands onto Emmett.
Guess fresh carp don't much agree with you after all. That be the case, you best learn not to be so uppity around white folks, and you damn well better not be coming around here asking for any food again. Seems to me you don't like what we got to offer.
Emmett knelt on all fours, coughing and spitting. When he caught his breath, he turned and glared at R.C., and then at me, before sliding into the shallow edge of the river and wading back to his cousins. They hadn't moved since R.C. woke up. R.C. picked up his pocket knife, wiped the blade on his pants leg, folded it closed, and shoved it into his pocket.
Let's get out of here, Hiram. I'm done fishing.
He picked up his stuff and headed back up the path to the truck. I stayed behind, sick to my stomach, embarrassed and scared. Emmett and his cousins waded upstream, with Emmett walking between two of them, leaning heavily on their shoulders. I wanted to say something, to yell that I was sorry, that I thought R.C. was evil and messed up, but they were too far to hear by then. Besides, I'd had my chance to do something, but all I'd done was watch R.C. humiliate that boy. I felt dirty and weak and ashamed. Chapter 9. During supper that night, I felt so lousy about what R.C. had done that I could hardly face Ruth Ann. Grandpa could tell I was upset, and before I could slip upstairs to sulk in my room, he said,
Hiram, let's go sit in the living room, and you can tell me what's eating you. Ever since you got home from fishing, you've looked more miserable than a crawdad in a stew pot.
Frankly, I was glad for the chance to unload my feelings on Grandpa, and he let me ramble about what had happened. I didn't get into all the gory stuff, but I did tell him that R.C. Rydell had done some awful things to a Negro boy while we were fishing. I could barely keep my voice from shaking. And the worst thing, Grandpa, was that I just stood there. I could have pulled him off, I should have done something, but I didn't know what to do. I felt my face turn red. Truth is, I was scared.
R.C. didn't do any permanent damage to the boy, just a little roughhousing that went too far. Besides, Hiram, boys like R.C. are as unpredictable as a mad dog. If you'd have gotten in his way, he might have ripped into you.
But I should have done something. You should have seen how that boy looked at me when he left. He thought I was his friend.
That's where he made his first mistake. Coloreds around here know better than to push themselves on white folks. There is no friendship between whites and coloreds. Never should be, never will be. Even a fool ought to know that.
R.C. wasn't just acting unfriendly, Grandpa. He was torturing him. It was crazy. Why would anybody act like that?
No explaining some people. Grandpa said. There are some ignorant white trash peckerwoods here in the Delta who are just plain mean. Maybe they've got things bad. Maybe they're mad about something. Maybe they can't hold their liquor. You can't understand them, son, and it's no use even trying.
Should I tell the sheriff?
Grandpa shook his head.
I'm sure Sheriff Smith knows all about R.C. Rydell. That boy's been in and out of trouble his whole life. From what I hear, most of it's just dumb old peckerwood things like bullying people, swearing in public, boozing. But one thing's sure. He doesn't have the brains or the gumption to do anything much worse than what he did today. I don't approve of what he did, but you also got to remember, Hiram, this is the Mississippi Delta. Sounds to me like that colored boy just didn't have any sense. R.C.'s no good, and I'm damn sorry for what happened, but that boy brought trouble on himself.
I didn't know what to think, and I didn't want to talk to Grandpa any longer. So I said goodnight and went upstairs to my room. Some of what Grandpa said about R.C. made sense, but I couldn't think of anything anybody could do to deserve getting treated the way Emmett had been. Why had R.C. been so hateful to a kid he didn't even know? And what if lots of people like R.C. existed? What if they all got together? They'd be dangerous to almost everyone, not just to Negroes. Back in Arizona, I'd heard about how the Mormons had been chased out of most places they had lived until they'd finally settled in Utah, a desert nobody wanted. It was hard to believe that Americans could be that cruel to other people just because of religion or race or anything. The Nazi slaughter of the Jews? That seemed different and worse. For one, it was an ocean away, foreigners hurting and killing other foreigners, and the Nazis weren't Americans. They didn't have the principles of freedom and democracy that we had. Maybe in a way they just didn't know any better, or maybe old Hitler was just able to pull off mass hypnosis or something. And maybe that's why Dad acted so crazy about the South and segregation. Maybe he realized that bullies would always find somebody to pick on, if not the Negroes and somebody else. And I didn't want it to be me or anybody I loved. In fact, I didn't want it to be anybody at all. My head was so jammed with troubles that night that I could hardly keep it still on my pillow. Plenty of my restlessness was because of what R.C. had done. But a whole lot of my tossing and turning came from my wondering if maybe Dad wasn't so crazy after all. Grandpa claimed he was feeling better, but his skin stayed gray and loose, and he hardly ever showed the passion for the things that he used to when I was little. I tried to talk him into going fishing once in a while, but he said he didn't think he'd have the energy to reel in anything bigger than a minnow. Normally, I would have been bored, but I knew I wasn't going to be in Greenwood much longer, so I didn't mind spending time with Grandpa. He still seemed lonely, and sometimes I worried about what he'd do when I was gone. Except for sitting around the house, checking on his land and doing business at the courthouse, the only thing Grandpa did that wasn't just regular living was his work on the White Citizens Council. He never talked to me about what exactly he did, but I figured he was some kind of big shot on the council. Some nights, two or three men would come over to talk to Grandpa about what was going on. Twice since I came to Greenwood, he'd left at night for council meetings and came back late, long after I was asleep. I figured it was boring political stuff he was working at, probably had something to do with battling desegregation and all that. Seeing him so involved reminded me of Dad, all worked up and smack in the middle of some issue. Thursday, I stayed close to home, spending as much time with Grandpa as I could, and it was like old times. After Ruth Ann's breakfast, Grandpa and I got into the pickup and drove over to the courthouse and then out to the fields. We didn't stay in either place very long and ended up at the River Cafe by noon. After lunch, we went home so he could take a nap. When he woke up, he sat in his favorite chair and read Civil War history books until Ruth Ann had supper ready. After supper, he went back to the living room to read the Greenwood Commonwealth, and we talked about the news, his childhood, and whatever else he felt like talking about. A knock at the door interrupted us, and Grandpa answered it. Some guy came by wanting to borrow the truck. "Keys are in it," Grandpa told him. "Just make sure it's got some gas left when you're done." He walked back to his chair, smiling. I could tell it made him feel good to help out his neighbors. Later that evening, some men picked Grandpa up for another council meeting. For a while after he left, I sat in the living room reading the newspaper and listening to the radio. The man who had borrowed the truck had already returned it, so I thought about taking it and cruising Greenwood. But there wasn't a whole lot to see in Greenwood at night. Besides, there really was only one person I wanted to see, even though I wasn't sure how I could see her or if she'd want to see me. By 10 o'clock, I was bored and restless, so I went for a walk. Greenwood's dead quiet at night, and as I walked along River Road, the only thing I heard, except for the buzz of the summer locusts and the sound of an occasional car or truck, was the soft flow of the Yazoo River down below the sidewalk. After a few blocks, I turned left on Fulton Street and walked onto the bridge that crossed the river. Halfway across stood a girl looking over the railing. The dim streetlight at one end didn't do much to break up the shadows that blanketed most of the bridge, but as I got closer, I could see that she had blonde hair and was staring at the dark water flowing beneath us. My chest got tight when I recognized her. She didn't move as I approached, and I had to work to take a breath before I spoke. "Naomi, what are you doing out here?" She answered without looking up, without a trace of surprise. "I'm looking at the river, Hiram Hilburn, and thinking about an old friend." I stood next to her. "Been here long?" "Just every night since I heard you were back in Greenwood." She bumped her shoulder into mine and turned her head so I could see her. Wow. She was even prettier than she was when we were kids. "Where have you been? Did living in Arizona make you forget your Mississippi friends?" "Naomi, don't go fretting about it, Hiram." She smiled and nudged me with her hip. "I'm just teasing.